Good afternoon and welcome to all of you here in the public library, those joining us via live stream to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's program featuring Dr. Mina Khandelwal speaking on the topic of climate change, gender, and biomass cook stoves in India. My name is Brett Cloyd. I'm an ICFRC board member and your host for today's program. As a reminder, we plan for this program to go until 1 p.m. today. This is our third program in our spring 2025 lineup and the first in our new four-part series, The Changing Environment, Adaptation, Resilience, and Sustainability. More information about the series is available on our website and on your tables with our new poster. We are deeply grateful for the longstanding support from our community. Your help has allowed our organization to grow for 41 years, hosting speaker programs with experts joining us in person and online from across the world. As a small nonprofit, we exist because of the generosity of individuals like you. As we head into 2025, opportunities for nonprofit funding beyond individuals is becoming more difficult as charitable organizations like ours face an uncertain future, especially when focused on uplifting research and stories advocating for marginalized, vulnerable, and international communities. Please consider donating by cash or check with the QR code on the table or in the hallway or online to keep our free educational programs available over the next year. ICFRC would like to give a heartfelt thank you to today's sponsors and partners, including the UI Center for Asian and Pacific Studies, TIPI's College of Business, the Office of Sustainability, and the Environment Center for Human Rights and International Studies, as well as 100 Grannies, Newman Monson Architects, and Midwest One Bank, and of course the Iowa City Public Library for providing partnership, space, and today's food. Thank you all for your support. We couldn't do it without you. Our next program will be Wednesday, March 12th at noon here in the Public Library. This program is titled Global Neighbors Welcoming and Supporting New Iowans in Des Moines. A new immigrant and refugee welcome center is opening in Polk County in 2025. The Hub for Refugees and Immigrants, which has been designed with community input to create an inclusive environment, will feature professionals who provide confidential and sensitive spaces, services related to employment, housing, and education, and transition programs for new Iowans living in the capital. Our speakers will share more about the first of its kind hub in Iowa and the county's plans for supporting its foreign-born population, the largest growing demographic group in our state. Please see our website, icfrc.org, for the rest of the spring's programs. Now with that, I'd like to introduce our speaker today. Mina Khandelwal is a feminist anthropologist known for her pioneering research on Hindu celibacy and monastic life that puts gender at the center of her work. She has a recent book called Cook Stove Chronicles, Social Life of Women's Technology in India. Here's what it looks like if you want to take a look. Or look for it at your local libraries. Mina is a recent recipient of the Provost and President's Teaching Award and also the International Engagement Teaching Award from International Programs at the University of Iowa. Please join me in welcoming Mina Khandelwal.
Thank you so much. I want to thank the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council and Brett Cloyd, Peter Gerlach, Cynthia Chow for inviting me to share my work with you today. This new book that has just come out is a sole authored book in my voice, but the whole Cook Stove project, it was the research is based on collaborative work across a set of unlikely disciplines, let's say, like GWIS and anthropology and engineering, archaeology, urban planning, and so on. The project has also only been possible because of various kinds of support that I and my colleagues have gotten over the years. So this picture you see here is of what is called a chula in Hindi. A biomass burning cook stove. It's a rather typical looking one. So these are stoves that are typically made of some combination of stone and brick and mud, although there's a lot of variations, variations in size, variations in shape, some variations in design, different parts of India, different households even within the same village. So they're handcrafted, right? They're handcrafted for the most part by the same people who are using them, which means that the stoves are built mostly by women to fit the specificities of their home and their cooking vessels and their cooking needs in general. So there are these kinds of traditional cook stoves or mud stoves, which are used all over the world, although my work is focused on India, have sort of come to be a center of attention worldwide over decades, and a real development to try women in these stoves and moving toward what might be called efficient cook stoves or improved cook stoves or clean cook stoves. Lots of different languages used. But these are the problems that are associated with these stoves, and in some cases, quite well-documented problems. So, cooking over an open fire emits smoke and particulate matter, and it's been pretty well demonstrated that women and children are the most affected, simply because they're the ones who tend to spend more time around the stove and indoors. In the 1970s, there was a lot of attention on the cook stove problem because of the fuel wood crisis around the world, because there wasn't enough fuel for people to cook in rural areas. So then it became, recognized as a big problem. But then also all these other layers of problems, deforestation, it's sometimes often seen as a major driver of deforestation. And then, around the turn of this century, these stoves come to be associated with climate change. So then there's a whole renewed set of interest in trying to come up with new, improved technologies. And because women are the ones who tend to do most of the cooking, not universally, but in general, they are the ones who are breathing in a lot of these emissions. They're also the ones who are generally, in most places in India, responsible for collecting the fuel wood to burn them. It's also seen as an effort to empower women in different ways. So I want to just describe for you some, and I'm just going to focus on four of the most common proposed solutions. So improved biomass cook stoves is the most obvious one, or often just, I use the acronym IBCS. That's also a mouthful, but so efforts to sort of design improved means stoves that allow for more efficient combustion, which that means it will use less fuel and it will produce less smoke, right? So that's generally the goal. So these efforts to design improved biomass cook stoves go all the way back to the 1940s in India. And for the most part, they've not really been very successful for a whole lot of reasons. There's no single reason. One, if you can imagine, so this is an example of an efficient biomass burning cook stove, and it burns wood. But compared to a regular mud stove, traditional mud stove, notice that the opening is very small, right? So that means you have to chop the wood into small, small pieces. And if you're doing that with an axe, that is very laborious work, right? So it can be very inconvenient. Or sometimes, this one is not, but some of them are top loading. You load the fuel from the top, and those are often used if the fuel is like pellets or briquettes, that sort of densified biomass. That can be a problem, because imagine if you have a big pot of boiling something, and then you have to pick it off and move it with tongs so that you can add fuel in the middle while you're cooking. So the sort of problem here is that these innovations, these technological innovations, they're motivated by trying to improve the efficiency of combustion, right? So the smaller opening, the top loading, all of those have a engineering purpose to them. But sometimes the very things that make a stove more efficient or more clean are the things that create more labor, or they're annoying, or they're inconvenient for whatever reason. So they also, these kinds of stoves, and this is just another version of one that's a little more fancy. It's actually built a little more like a traditional stove with some, it's usually a clay and cement composite mixture with two burners, and then that thing there which holds water so you can heat water. So water gets heated while you're also cooking, which is kind of nice. But these stoves, they all have manufactured parts. They have parts that break, and often that's a problem, that it can be hard or even impossible to A, get the parts, or repair it on your own. So then you maybe need to bring in some expert to repair the stove. They're often not very durable. They lack prestige because, you know, that's not what rich people use for their cooking. So, you know, it's usually a kind of technology that's pushed on poor people rather than something that they're clamoring to have. The parts, because these are metal parts, they get very hot, so that can be a burn risk. They can also be unstable. I was once in a village, and we were kind of preparing. It was kind of a big deal. We were preparing for a tea party with the women in the village, and we had bought supplies from the city, and, you know, they had put that stove, looked a lot like that, on a somewhat sloped place, because this is kind of a hilly part of India, Rajasthan, where we're working, in the Aravallis, and it tips over and spills hot tea everywhere. So not only is it dangerous, but it was also a kind of tragic waste of precious ingredients. And then there are solar stoves. What could possibly go wrong with that? A lot of things. One, it is difficult to use that kind of stove. This is actually a prototype of a stove created by my engineering colleagues here at the University of Iowa and then given to a few homes in the villages in the Aravalli region of Rajasthan where we were working. But it's difficult to use this kind of stove. It's a butterfly design on a hilly terrain. It's not very stable, right? It also doesn't store energy, because for solar, storage is really the big problem. So people in these villages have cell phones that they might charge with solar, but the phone will hold the charge, right? A flashlight will hold the charge, but the stove needs a lot more energy, so you can't have that storage without really building up the cost of, and so these are also supposed to be cheap technologies. So that means that women have to stand outside in the midday sun in Rajasthan, where in the hot part of the year it might be 120 degrees Fahrenheit easily, right? Have to stand out in the midday sun and cook. So that's not very desirable. It's also difficult to cook holding a small child, because women in these villages generally sit and cook. They don't stand and cook, and it's a very awkward kind of design. And also, women who got this prototype found that they kind of missed going to the forest with their friends to collect fuel wood, right? So there's the whole social aspect of that as well. So, and then there's biogas. So Indian engineers have actually done a lot of work on household level biogas. The government has promoted it, and there's been sort of decades of research on this. So these biogas stoves were designed by scientists and inventors, like going back to the mid 20th century in India. And biogas just refers to a mixture of methane and carbon dioxide that's used as fuel, and that's produced by the bacterial decomposition of organic waste. And those organic wastes can be lots of different things. So biogas can be made from industrial facilities of organic waste, or, you know, spoiled food or kitchen waste or human excrement. That never seems to be able to take off in India. I think people are just too disgusted by the idea of cooking with biogas. So at least that's the theory of some public health scholars. But also from manure, like cow dung. And this image that you see here is cow dung in Hindi is called gobar. So this is gobar gas, gobar biogas. People just call it biogas. And this was a house that I visited in southern Rajasthan. And sort of here's the digester. You probably can't see it, but there's one little cow up there. It's kind of tiny and blends into the background. But, you know, you need maybe two or three cows to be able to get enough energy for cooking and maybe some lighting in your house. So, and women usually manage this. They collect the cow dung, they put it in this digester, and they get methane. So that gets transported into the kitchen with this is actually a rubber hose. You can kind of see it. It's kind of draped around, and then it goes through this little hole into the kitchen, and that door leads into the kitchen. So it cleans, it burns clean, right? At the point, there's no smoke that comes with that, at least at the point of cooking. So, and then, of course, we have to talk about LPG or gas. LPG is, of course, prepared by refining crude oil. And it's almost entirely derived from fossil fuels sources. And for decades, it has been the preferred cooking fuel in middle class and affluent households in India. And it generally comes in these canisters like we use for backyard grills. Partly in response to all the ongoing challenges, which I just talked about, of getting women to use improved biomass cook stoves, decades, like for more than half a century, people have been trying to get women to use these improved biomass cook stoves. And mostly, there's a consensus that those efforts have not really been successful or led to any kind of widespread adoption of these stoves. So in 2016, the government of India did a complete about-face and changed course by launching this program, the Pradhan Mantri Ujjwala Yojana, often just referred to as Ujjwala, which means light. A massive program of subsidies and distribution networks and public messaging to facilitate a nationwide transition away from cooking with solid biomass. It's been very successful by most measures, over 100 million distributed with the subsidy, like to people who didn't have it before. Okay, so now I want to tell a story starting with this, of solid biomass. So this plop of biomass lying on the ground from a cow or some kind of bovine can take two different pathways to produce heat for cooking, right? Depending on which technologies are used. And by technologies, I'm referring both to the device, like a cooking device, but also the techniques and the methods of doing something. Both are kinds of technologies. And what I'd like to focus on today is how different technologies support particular kinds of social relationships. I'm a social scientist, right? So we always want to think about the social embeddedness of technologies. So what cultural meanings and ecologies, social and economic relations make various cooking technologies possible or desirable? So let me just describe two different pathways to get of how this cow dung could be processed in different ways to become two different things, two different kinds of cooking fuel that have very different social arrangements and health implications. So first we'll talk about gobar or cow dung patties or cakes, they're often called. So women would women do all over India, rural places especially. They mix cow dung with maybe some dried hay or agro waste, and they pat it into discs, and they put these discs in the sun to dry. And they might be laid out on the ground in very tidy ways generally, or even, you know, slapped on the side of a wall or a house in designs that are very pleasing to the eyes. There's certainly an aesthetic sense to it. So they're then stored, and they're there for to use as cooking fuel as needed. So when these dried cow dung cakes are burned in a chula or a traditional stove, they emit smoke that public health experts have shown to be deadly. It's dirty fuel. They see it as dirty fuel. But it's also, as a product of the cow, dung cakes are deemed as a pure fuel by Hindus, devout most Hindus. So as a cooking fuel, it burns very slowly, so it's good for slow-cooked kinds of dishes. Women typically build these stoves themselves, and this is actually not a good example of the traditional stove, but it's kind of an ad hoc way, one that's made from a clay pot, but you saw the picture of the more traditional one earlier. So women build those generally themselves based on common knowledge, right, and from materials mostly found in the immediate environment or the nearby environment. So these stoves are thus custom fitted to accommodate the cook's house, their family size, which is related to the size of their cooking vessels, and it supports women's autonomy. That's one of my arguments, right, that it's flexible technology, it's adaptable, and it supports women's autonomy. So in rural India, women are usually the ones to collect and process fuel, whether that's firewood or cow dung cakes. So this is my explanation for why these old stoves, the chula, persists despite decades, like more than half a century of efforts to replace it with all sorts of alternative clean and efficient cooking. So a woman can say, hey, I made this with my own hands, and I produced the fuel, right, with my own hands, without need for any cash, and without need to get my husband to go get the refill or something like that, right? So that's one pathway. So the other pathway would be biogas. So in this, instead of drying it, women would take the cow dung and mix it with water in this concrete digester, as I just said, and the bacteria promotes decomposition to produce methane. So this gas then travels through that rubber tube, or it might be a steel pipe, small steel pipe, to provide clean in the sense of smokeless cooking, without emitting smoke in the kitchen. So one advantage is it can be turned on and off quickly, just like any kind of like electricity or LPG. But the cement digester and the other parts are manufactured from steel, iron, and rubber. They must be purchased or provided by the government or a nonprofit. And women may have less knowledge of and control over this technology. And I think more research is needed on the gendered aspects of this. So it's a low-tech configuration, biogas. But it's impossible to build from collected and organic materials, right? It just has this different kind of materiality to it. And women generally are the ones who manage it. So while there's much to love about biogas systems, they require initial monetary investment to build, as well as manufactured parts and specialized knowledge to repair. And some see biogas as the best solution to the stove problem, because it produces heat, but not smoke while cooking, because it comes from a renewable source, right, biomass, and because its byproduct is actually a really high-quality organic fertilizer. So I agree, there's a lot to love about biomass, but despite government promotion, it's not really succeeded in and the cost outlay. So innovations in cooking technologies can involve the fuel, the device, or both. And regardless, there's always social implications. So let's add LPG into this comparison. So Ujwala, or the government program, has been hailed and celebrated by many as a success. Connections have been distributed widely all over India, and these LPG stoves and cylinders are increasingly visible in remote villages. I've seen that change. And this vast distribution system now exists, even outside major cities, and it's also created jobs for that reason. So there's definitely a change underway regarding this transition to LPG. But there are several caveats that have been widely acknowledged. Like, it still remains out of reach for the most marginalized people. People find it inconvenient to replace an empty tank, and most people don't have two tanks. So you're cooking and your tank gets empty, you've got to figure out something to finish cooking dinner. So many families who are happy to have acquired LPG through these programs do not actually transition to gas. They may use LPG for quick tasks, especially like making tea and things like that, but they use the traditional stove for many things, in many cases, most of their cooking. So while LPG has clear benefits for health and convenience, I'd like to share some of my concerns that I don't see raised in the literature about the social, economic, and political arrangements that are associated with LPG as a cooking fuel. So first, the Modi administration worked in partnership with India's three major private oil companies to promote LPG by relying on digital infrastructure involving electronic bank accounts, biometric identification cards, and cell phones. You need all that stuff to get that subsidy. The environmental costs of this transition need to also be part of the calculation. So aside from LPG being a fossil fuel, which people do debate and talk about, digital technologies have their own materiality, right? They rely on rare earth metals, lithium, and energy-intensive server farms that need access to cheap water and energy, as well as greenhouse gases, of course, emitted from internet infrastructures. But more than that, the shift to LPG for cooking also results in women's loss of control over cooking technologies. They become dependent on government subsidies and or cash, and they become integrated into global fossil fuel markets. So they become consumers of technology, both the stove and the fuel, rather than producers of it. So this integration into petroleum economies has numerous implications that I feel do not get attention. So LPG is largely imported and subject to a lot of price volatility, as you can imagine. Very long commodity chains, which means, so LPG is desired because it's a very dense, because it has very high levels of energy density, and so therefore it's very efficient in producing heat at the point of cooking. But apart from the carbon emissions during use, there's also emissions all along the supply chain. Gas cylinders are distributed by trucks and vans using diesel and petrol, and none of this seems to be taken into part of the, as part of the calculation. Contrast this just for a minute of women who walk to the forest in groups to collect fuel wood for cooking. Also, crude oil comes from very few sources, so access to it is easily controlled, and the petroleum products are easily commodified. So fossil fuel extraction requires massive capital investment and sophisticated technologies. And so for that reason, petroleum economies support highly masculine and authoritarian forms of governance worldwide, generally. In contrast, cow dung and fuel wood are dispersed sources of energy, right, requiring none of that. I'm not saying that people shouldn't get LPG gas. I'm not saying that at all. But maybe it shouldn't be called clean cooking. And it only really makes sense from a very narrow public health perspective if the only thing you're measuring is indoor air pollution, right? But there's so many other things one might also want to measure for a sort of more holistic perspective. I mean, also the dynamics that I've described help to explain why so many women like having LPG at home, but they don't want to throw out their old chulas, right? And so I think we should be more honest about the kinds of economies that it requires, LPG requires, and how these economies are highly gendered. So clearly there's a problem with LPG, and or the many problems with LPG, and the solution needs to be renewables at some level, right? Biomass, of course, is a renewable, and many people are working on this. But because, like, fuels and technologies also have a social life, simply replacing LPG with renewables, whatever that renewable is, will not in itself change the social arrangement of energy provision. So this is why many researchers and activists say that we need a just transition. And this is aligned with other frameworks like environmental justice, energy, democracy. And so in the beginning of, I talked about how cow dung becomes cooking fuel. But cow dung is often a last resort fuel when people don't have access to firewood. So firewood is the more desirable fuel wood generally. And collecting fuel wood requires access to natural resources and land in particular. So I think we need to talk about land a little bit here, both because forests provide fuel wood and because looking at land also helps us see the difference between small-scale subsistence economies and big market logics. So let me talk about land for a little bit. You'll indulge me. It's just a little detour, and I promise I will come back to the cook stove. So land is many things, right? For people in many parts of rural India, and especially women, land is a source of food, fuel, and fodder. It's the basis for your livelihood. Might be a place to build a home. It might be a place where the spirits reside or your ancestors reside. It can also be a place to protect a forest, harvest water, supply what we like to call environmental services. It could be a place where one would mine for various kinds of minerals. It could be a source of profit through use, such as farming. And it can be a source of profit through speculation rather than farming, right? So it can be lots of different things. And you can't roll up a plot of land like a mat and move it to another location, as you can with coal or oil or diamonds or other commodities. But you can define land narrowly as ownable property, right? And then as something that can be bought and sold as a commodity. And you can keep people out through, you know, fences, guns, regulations like zoning laws, formal property law, or through market mechanisms, like it's just too expensive for people to have access to that land. So we're thinking about land, we have to think about John Locke. John Locke had a huge impact on India and actually many parts of the world. So John Locke argued that value is created by physical work, which justifies private property. Settled cultivation on individually enclosed lands defines civilization. And this is like the Jeffersonian ideal of the farmer. And according to John Locke, conquest is acceptable in territories where land is lying waste, right? So this idea of waste or wasteland becomes a very important mechanism by which many, especially marginalized people in the world, get displaced from land and displaced from their livelihoods. And the category wasteland was formally put into Indian law in the late 1700s, and it referred to lands that hadn't, in the eyes of the British officials, was not being used, right? Was being wasted. So one of the things that happened during British colonialism was a gradual kind of enclosure of the commons, right? Commons is land that is not owned by privately and is not owned by the state or the government. It's just common land. And, the Forest Department in India, which was set up by the British colonial state, was established in order to raise revenue. That was the purpose of it, through timber production. And tree plantations, if you think about them, are always sort of focused on a single species of commercial value, any kind of plantation. That is the plantation model of production. You're focused on a particular species that is your commercially valuable thing that you're trying to produce. In this case, that thing is timber. And everything else, with that laser focus of the plantation model, everything else becomes either irrelevant or actively has to be removed. So you can see where, so if let's say pine trees is your crop that you're producing, then anything else is a weed or a pest and should be removed, right? And including underbrush, right? But the problem is those things that are considered to be irrelevant and a problem in the plantation are the things that often provide food and fodder for local people, fuel wood, medicines, shelter, all the kinds of things that they need for their daily lives. So what, and I'm really talking in very broad terms here, the commons, like under, this is a lot of what happened under colonial rule and then continued after India's independence in 1947. So the state kind of continued a lot of these policies of the Forest Department. So what is the commons, meaning land that is important for people's livelihoods to get fuel, wood, and things like that first gets misidentified as wasteland or barren land or underutilized land or empty land. And then once that's done, that is defined as wasteland, then it becomes useful for other purposes, right? Tree plantations of the colonial state or farmland for global investment with TIA Nuveen has been very involved in. Some of us have been trying to get them to be more accountable on that. Mega solar parks, right? In climate change, a lot of the mitigation is about promoting these huge solar parks in global south countries, like India is one of them. But then those solar parks for the common good become a way of enclosing the commons and displacing people whose livelihoods depend on that land. Or forest conservation for carbon offsets. So these, as you can imagine, this is where political conflict happens around the environment in a place like India. And people talk about sort of affluent environmentalism of like national parks and things like that, and then environmentalism of the poor, which is more about livelihoods, right? Basic livelihoods. So back to stoves. I promise you I come back to stoves. So efforts to improve biomass cook stoves in India have been reinvigorated by the Sustainable Development Goals of the UN and carbon markets, which were created by the Kyoto Protocol. So the Kyoto Protocol was first implemented in 2005. It created these certified emission reduction credits that could be bought and sold, right? And could be used to count towards meeting Kyoto targets for countries, let's say. So over the last decade, hundreds of carbon offsetting projects distributed improved cook stoves across India and other global south countries. Okay, so first there was decades of work on biomass cook stoves, and then there's LP. Everybody's like, forget that. That has not been working. We're going to go to LPG. And then these changes kind of reinvigorate biomass research on biomass cook stoves. It's a little complicated if you're not very, very familiar with the carbon credit system, but a measure of greenhouse gases that are not released, right? So you have to measure the savings or the what is not happening. Like if you didn't have this intervention or this new stove, there would be so much more emissions, and that's what the thing that you have to measure. So that is converted into carbon credits that corporations and governments and individuals can buy to compensate for their own emissions, right? So maybe they then don't have to reduce their own emissions because they can do all these projects in faraway countries generally. So this is where this problem comes in for me, because this was very central to, and this goes back to what I talked about at the beginning of the presentation. Stove stacking is a widely recognized issue for everybody who works on cook stoves. You see, this is the kitchen I visited, my standard looking kitchen in a village. And I don't know if you can see it, but there's a traditional cook stove here in the corner. And then there's an LPG tank there and the LPG. And so this is very common now. As people get LPG, they don't throw out their old stoves, right? So they use both. They use different kinds of fuel, and they use both, and this is called stove stacking. I'll just share a couple of stories from my own research that kind of illustrate the problem of stove stacking for carbon credit systems. So in one home I visited in 2018, where there was LPG and also what looked like a traditional stove, but family members explained to me that so it looked actually kind of like that, right? Family members explained to me that some strangers had come from the city, and they broke their old earthen mud stove, and then they built this one with the promise that it would burn more efficiently and save them fuel wood, and that they should use it and stop using those old stoves. The family, however, was not using this so-called improved stove because it was too large for their pots, hence wasteful and inefficient, and because it was made from a cement composite material such that, you know, when there was a crack in it, the mud would not adhere when they tried to repair a crack, right? So, of course, they're not using it. But that person who came and built it, or the organization, they didn't even know who the person was or what organization they were from, probably checked off a box that this family has now adopted that improved cook stove and is using it, right? So there's very little follow-up. In another home I visited, the family had a gas stove that they had procured only a year earlier. The matriarch of the family said that she used to cook on the mud stove that both built and repaired, that she built and repaired herself, and she would go with a group of neighborhood women to the forest for fuel wood. After getting a gas stove, she said she missed the time with her friends, but she liked having LPG because it had two burners and she could cook, her cooking was twice as fast because she could cook the bread and the vegetables at the same time. Then I'm there for about an hour, then she leads me around to the back of the house where they have their buffalo and they have the traditional chula in a corner in the back of the house. And she says, you know, in the first article of the conversation, they make it sound like they only use the traditional chula to cook cottonseed porridge for their buffalo. And but then, you know, within 20 minutes, I'm learning that, oh, they're using it for almost everything these days because the cost of LPG is high, right? But it takes a long time to get to that point because people want to say they're using LPG. So the inability of quantitative measures to accurately represent messy realities of people's actual behavior is the problem with carbon financing, or one of the problems with carbon financing. One recent study found that offsets related to cook stoves are likely overstating emissions reductions, because remember that's the thing that's being measured, by as much as 8 times. This was a paper that just came out last year. So the abstraction of modeling used to estimate emission reductions produces a lack of transparency. And the projects are generally done by maybe governments or large corporations in wealthy countries, and they're implementing projects in other parts of the world, right, in faraway places. But they don't really, they don't know what's going on in that woman's home or her kitchen, right? They just don't have that kind of fine-grained understanding or contact with the implementation, the end of the implementation part of it. So that's a problem in my mind. So I started with cow dung. I'm going to end with cow dung. So I describe cow dung as a local organic fuel that burdens women with a lot of work, but also supports their autonomy at the same time. But hey, now you can also buy cow dung on Amazon or at Walmart. It's used, people would buy it for, not for cooking, but for Hindu rituals. So they can be, these cow patties can be delivered to your door, all neatly wrapped in plastic. This is not the same economy as the woman who collects cow dung near her home to use for cooking fuel. Right? It's the same material substance, but embedded in very different kind of social and economic arrangements, arrangements of production and distribution. So just as solar energy can be organized in a very authoritarian way, as it often is with these mega solar parks, it can also be organized in a more democratic way, and there are many people who are working on that. Like, they're working on solar energy, but they're working on it with this understanding of social relationships matter, and we have to also think about that, not just the technology. So Peter asked me to end with a few suggestions for what we might, suggestions for the audience. So these are just some ideas I have of you know, what we can do. I think there's a lot we can do. I know this is a pretty depressing time for thinking about climate change, but I think it's really helpful to focus on social relationships, and because it brings the scale down. And maybe it's not the governments that are going to solve this problem for us. And so here's, I would just you know, like you to know about the Community Economies Institute, and there's a website there. I actually brought a handout with some of this information on it for anyone who's interested. And, you know, which is about, which, and this, iceberg is part of, what they talk about, this diverse communities, that we need to support and cultivate diverse kinds of communities, different kinds of modes of production, different kinds of distribution based on, you know, more positive kinds of social relationships. And then the Eco-Tipping Point Project models success, again, at a human scale of all kinds of environmental projects in different parts of the world. And I guess just for us individually, the common sense things, use less, waste less. I tell you, spending time in some of these villages in India, it really makes me aware of, like, the unbelievable waste that we just, Americans, just thoughtlessly engage in, right, on a day-to-day basis. But nurture the commons, build community, support local organizations who are doing this work, and there are many of them, and advocate for University of Iowa right now, where a lot of these things, if you think these kinds of things are important to be teaching, there are lawmakers in Iowa who would like us to not be teaching these things and think that students should not be learning these things. So pay attention to what's happening in the state and at the university and advocate for us, if you agree with me on that. And then, of course, local businesses, support local businesses, always. Thank you. Attention.
Presentation. We're going to move on to our question and answer portion of the program. If you have a question for our speaker, please raise your hand and I will bring a microphone to you. Okay, we've got one already.
Let me share these with, I think I had 25.
Some handouts? Okay, yeah, let me.
So, because I'm a teacher, I brought a handout. Couldn't help myself.
This is a bit off topic, but in the early 60s, one of my relatives in the Peace Corps was in India, and at that time, their goal was to vent the interior of the structures people lived in because of the cook stoves. What is that still a problem?
So the very first cook stove, the very first improved cook stoves were to add a chimney, right, to vent the smoke out of the home, because the concern was about indoor air pollution. And then the thinking changed on that, and there was a realization that, well, ambient air pollution is as much of a problem, so just moving the smoke out of the home doesn't really solve the problem, and it doesn't address the climate issues. And also there were problems in homes like snakes coming through the chimneys, I mean, all kinds of different problems. And so it came to be recognized that that in itself wasn't really a solution, and then there was more of a focus on making stoves more efficient.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
So I had one question, actually. The thing was that the one of the problem with LPG cylinder may be that it can explode when there will be, like,
yeah,
and not with the traditional one. So, and many are not careful so that you can switch it off in the night or something, or after cooking. And that may pose danger to the people or the community, I think. I don't know.
I did have some conversations with women in some villages about that, and it was kind of interesting. It seemed like the older women were scared of these explosions. And everyone said, oh, that happened in their village, but they all knew somebody who had had this problem of a canister exploding. So there was, yeah, it's not without any danger, right, LPG. Thank you. For those questions.
You made a very brief comment about an action that TIA is taking. Can you expand on that? That was a brief comment, but I was just curious if you can expand on that a little bit.
Well, you can go to the website TIAA Divest, and there's been a lot of activism around this issue for the last, I don't know, at least 5 years, because TIA through Nuveen, which is their TIA. Nuveen is the largest farmland asset holder in the world. But, and you know, it's all couched in a lot of green, pretty pictures of green farmlands, you know, and that they're helping farmers and all of that. But there's a lot of research that suggests it's pretty deceptive, and they're really promoting the worst industrial farming practices, and also related to what I talked about. You know, there's some very sketchy practices in how they're acquiring some of this land in Brazil in particular. And if you go to that website, there's a lot of information about that.
Mina, thank you so much. What an excellent talk, and I really appreciated all the different angles that you took, as well as very strong point about the colonial period and the legacies.
Okay, it wasn't too much. I thought maybe I was cramming
too much. I really appreciated that. We don't just arrive where we are,
right.
You know, in the last year or so, or last 10 years. It's a long history. My question is sort of about the larger context around pollution. So your talk today made me think a lot about when I lived in Mongolia, and there are similar concerns about stoves and burning within smaller home dwellings in yurts and or wooden houses, and a big part of the problem is the density of those homes in proximity to each other, and the ways in which generally in Mongolia they encircle, cities, for example. Where I lived, it was sort of encircled by a Ger district, and so it was very much a part, you know, the how people cook and what they use to burn was very much wrapped in conversations around pollution and how that contributes to a larger national conversation around how do we limit pollution and what do we do about the devices that people are using to cook. And I wonder if there are any parallels at all to any kind of conversation around larger issues with pollution in India.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. I mean, that's Delhi is notoriously polluted, especially in the winters, and there's always a lot of talk about that. And the causes are almost universally identified as cook stoves and the burning of agro waste in farms around the city, right? And I don't know, there's just like not much discussion about middle class lives and the sort of increase in personal cars, and like it just like always feels like we're blaming the poorest people for environmental problems and not, you know, giving enough responsibility to more privileged people. Now, I think in terms of what you're talking about in Mongolia, I guess this is, so one thing so this is the great thing about collaborating. One of my collaborators is Jerry Anthony, who is in urban planning, and he teaches a course on sustainable housing in India. And he really sort of, you know, helped me sort of pay more attention to housing construction, right? And Mongolia's cold, right? So probably the houses are more closed up. And I think this is where you'll see a lot of variation in different parts of India, right? Where in Rajasthan, where we were working, in the traditional style of the home has a clay roof that's quite porous. So some of the smoke goes out. And also in these indigenous Bhil villages where we were working, people are very scattered throughout the landscape, which is not true in other areas where people live, you know, very close together. So I feel like that makes a difference. Also, I found that if people build a modern style cement home, they don't want to put a traditional stove in that. Because that, there's no porous, like modern cement homes are closed in. And they also don't want the soot on their walls, their nice new home, right? So, but they'll usually keep the chula, but it'll be outside the house or it'll be on the roof or something like that. So I think like housing construction makes a difference. Also in places where it's cold in particular, like the traditional stove is also providing heat. Not just for, like it's, and maybe providing light if people don't have electricity. So, you know, you can't just solve the cooking problem without addressing the other uses of the stove, right? And a lot of the efficient stoves take away those other things that are actually benefits to people. Like light, well, those kinds of things. I don't know if that answered your question, but yeah.
So thank you for being here. I was really looking forward to this presentation. When I was in Nepal a few years ago, I walked around the side of a rural home, and there was the cement cylinder, like the biomass that you had talked about.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated by it. I asked our tour guide. He had no clue, so he asked the owner. And so he was telling about the waste in there and piping it in. You could see the pipe going into the house for the methane gas.
Right.
So my question is, those people got paid for us tourists to be there. Mm-hmm. Were they maybe more affluent? And how prevalent were those kinds of bio-waste cylinders?
I feel like it does tend to be more like in a village where people are generally pretty marginalized compared to the rest of the country. I have found that it is the more affluent households that are likely to have biogas because it is an outlay of money and time to manage. It has to be really managed every day, right? So. One of the NGOs that we worked with in India has really done a lot of work on biogas in a particular village, not one where we were working, but we did go to visit it. It does feel a little frustrating to many people that it seems like such a great solution, but it's not working for everybody, and it's not like it hasn't just taken over India. It doesn't do you any good unless you have some cows. Right? And those are going to be the more affluent people. The poorest people don't have any cattle.
Can you say the question?
What do you think about the solar ovens, right? Because they can be placed outside.
And left there.
I think it depends what you're cooking, right? And also they have to be moved a lot. And there's all those other problems with the technology, right? Of that the parts break, they're kind of delicate. People have been working on solar cooking stoves in India for more than a century. And it's not, they just haven't, so you're talking about passive solar, right? Yes. I mean, I would like to get one and try it because I kind of want to know how it works and what are actually the challenges of cooking it. So that's one of my goals. In India, so there's been so much pushing of solar. What you'll find is it's like environmentally oriented middle class people who might use it, not poorest people.
This cook stoves and the cook stove technology and the collection of firewood and all of that seems to be very much a gendered thing, and we get to hear about how it's impacting upon the women.
Right.
But I was wondering if you give us some insights into how the men, have been looking at all of these things and the changes and all of that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the problem is there's not the men. There's not one the men, right? There's all the the government people. Pushing LPG and celebrating it as this great thing for women, which in some ways it is, right? There are the men who are distributing and making a living in that economy. There are men, so I have written about and co-authored a paper with some colleagues on, what we see as the over-focus on women's kitchen cooking and ignoring all the other places in which wood gets burned as fuel. And a lot of those places you'll see men more involved, right? Like restaurants, or catering operations, or charcoal making. Charcoal, it's made in the villages, right, from wood, so all the pollution goes in the villages, but then the charcoal gets sent to urban areas for, fancy restaurants to use for their grilling stuff or, wedding parties or things like that. So, men do also cook. I do argue that the chulla is a women's technology, but I don't mean that in a way like men never cook or men never use these cook stoves. I mean it like it's generally associated with women symbolically, and most of them have the knowledge to make it. But we also found that these cook stoves are ad hoc, all kinds of workplaces. Like we went to a furniture factory and all the workers were living on site and they're cooking, they just put together some bricks and they're all men and they're cooking. Lots of work sites where workers are living on site are using these traditional stoves. But the focus is almost entirely on village women in their kitchens, in the villages. And it just is a little bit too narrow in my mind. If your concern is about burning wood, there's lots of other ways wood is burned in bigger quantities. And funeral pyres being one of them. Massive quantities of wood being burned for funeral pyres in India. Right? Massive quantities. I even visited one of those places, saw that.
Thank you.
Also because it's pure. It's a pure fuel. They also have a gas cremation thing right there in the same place, but they said only the poorest people use that who don't have money to buy wood, then the government would pay for that gas cremation. So it wasn't really being used the way it was intended. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
That
thank
was
you
an excellent
so much.
Presentation.
All the great questions.
Thank you so much. That was excellent, wonderful presentation. For our audience, we hope to see you all here next Wednesday, March 12th at noon for our next program. It's titled Global Neighbors, Welcoming and Supporting New Iowans in Des Moines with Max Oseska and Stephanie Morris. Thank you so much for attending today's program. We look forward to seeing you soon.